All right. Welcome back to the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. We have Dan Carey in our little studio. We have been graciously able to set up here at Riverside overlooking our beautiful copper kettles. Not only are we joined by Dan today, but we have Finnegan and Tucker here, two King Charles Cocker Spaniels. How are you and the dogs doing today, Dan?
We're doing all right. Deb is traveling, so I'm babysitting.
And I always like when I come in and I see the dogs, because it's a very dog friendly place.
The brewery. Yeah, and I don't definitely.
I don't hear people talking about that. Before we get to our topic, and now that I'm on this, I kind of want to know about this. How did the brewery become so dog friendly for team members?
Well, Deb, of course, loves animals, all animals, and she's always had dogs around her, and so she brings her dogs to work. And of course, the dogs aren't in the brewery; they're in the office, so they're not out in the plant, not in the food production area, but in the office, where the office staff is. Deb has her dogs, and then people started to bring their own dogs. So I don't know; there must be at any given time 5 or 6 dogs running around the office, but. I think most people are happy with it. Sometimes they get a little bit rowdy, but they're happy. Dogs are friendly people mostly, and so they're nice to have around.
They really are one of my favorites up there. Now, Tucker and Finn, notwithstanding, I don't even know the dog's name. It's just the one I call the big dog.
Oh, that's Case.
Case. Every time he comes up to me, it's just the dopiest dog in the whole world. Just, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's funny how they have such diverse personalities, because the little tiny pug, she's like the big dog. She's really, really small, but she's the loudest. She's the biggest personality. And the biggest dog of the bunch, physical size, is Case. And Case is just pure joy. Like when you walk in the room, he's like, hey, how you doing? Everything's great.
I love my life. I'm going to lick your shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Tuck's the old cavalier, and he's like, I don't like all these troublemakers. And he goes and hides underneath the desk somewhere and kind of chills out till he can go home.
Somewhere in an alternate universe, they are all working in an office somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
But the reason we're here today is we have a topic that I'm really interested in talking about. And given that it's, you know, it's the 30th anniversary year of New Glarus, and just up to this point in the year, you've come out with 30th anniversary, a Belgian quad, which is a new brand that's under the thumbprint for statewide distribution. New Glarus Pilsner, which is a new seasonal that's out there as we speak. And then, you know, a couple of R&Ds sort of already under the belt.
And at least one more new beer coming out later this summer.
And this is what's got me really, really excited, is that there is more new beer to come, sort of ramping up as you move along through your 30th anniversary here. So what I was really interested in talking about is new recipe development and new recipe writing, and how that process plays out. I have only seen one very tiny bit of that process, and I had sat on a tasting panel for a beer that is not out there quite yet. Yeah,
it will be later this summer.
That is good news to hear, because that was a fun tasting panel to sit on.
Sure.
But that's my only experience with sort of recipe writing. And I thought to myself, well, if you have an interest in writing recipes, you do sit across the desk from one of America's premier craft brewers in the industry. You might as well ask him. So, Dan, can you walk me through a little bit how the process for coming up with a new beer sort of begins, like its genesis, and we'll kind of move on from there.
Well, the ideas for a concept for a beer can come from many different sources. We have in the fall on our website a vote. You can write in and vote for a beer that you want us to brew. So there's two classes. There's, you know, we've made in excess of 200 different types of beer. So you can write in and say, why don't you make, you know, whatever, Edelpils again.
Tail Wagger.
Yeah. Or whatever. And then there's a second grouping of beers that we've never brewed that you would like us to make. Why don't you make something in X style? So we look at those scores, and there might be, the voting could end up with a beer having like one or two votes. or it might have 300 or 400 votes mm-hmm. that people really want us to make Enigma or whatever. And that will help us to understand what at least people who are, willing to write in are asking for. So that's one thing. And then we also look at what, where the market is trending, what people are interested in, because obviously if we brew a beer, our hope is that it'll sell. We also have internal hunches about things that we're thinking would be interesting. And then there's also maybe beers that I would think would be kind of interesting to brew or that I have a hunch, mm-hmm. like the Pilsner. I'm always wanting to brew Pilsners, and the market seems to be kind of coming my way. So that's why we made the Pils this year. So we look at all of those things and we then have a meeting twice a year where we sit down, the brewing staff and Deb and the salespeople, and we ruminate on what the brand calendar would look like for the following year, what we want to make, what fits. So, we want to make a dark stout, for example, in the winter. We want to make a light, easy drinking beer in the summer. And we move these pieces around the board to try to come together with a plan that fits the market movement and what we feel people will respond to. And we put together a brand calendar based on these beers. And sometimes they're new beers, like Gyrator was an example where Deb said, in the winter, I'd like a strong dark beer. So what do you guys think?
Yeah. What's on the top of your mind when I say those words?
Yeah. I'd like something rich and malty. Let's make a double buck. Okay. A double buck sounds good. And then we would go about creating that beer. And in the case of Gyrator, my education, my experience is mainly in lager brewing. Mm-hmm. So that was a relatively, and we've made lots of Bock beers before. And so it was relatively easy for me to imagine what that beer would be. And based on, many years of experience brewing similar beers, I don't think we made a test brew. We just I just wrote it and we brewed it.
So in a case like Gyrator, experience sort of drives the ship. Like you're like, okay, I have a really nice test pilot brewery within my brew house. However, this will be my X amount of Doppelbox I made. I know with the ratios and the recipe I'm writing that I think I'm hitting the mark I'm aiming at.
Yeah, pretty much. Writing a recipe or coming up with a plan is the result of, your experiences and understanding the raw materials, understanding the equipment that you have mm-hmm. and what the key points are. Brewing a beer has more to do with so many kilos of X malt and so many kilos of X hop and so many this temperature, that temperature. It has to do with things that are less tangible, like the equipment that you have, the brew house that you have designed. How is the brew house set up as far as things like oxygen pickup and mixer speeds and louder ton rake designs and how the kettle boil will affect hop aroma and bitterness extraction, how your water is, how you treat your water. All of those things are kind of not something that you would see on a piece of paper, but they're things that you learn from experience that when I do this, I have this outcome. Textbooks tell me that, for example, for a dark beer, I want to have a thicker mash than, say, a light beer with a thinner mash. So the mashing process might be a little bit thicker. Plus, it's a stronger beer, so the mash has to be thicker. And I may want my mash pH to be on the higher side than, say, a lighter colored beer. So all of these things you know from brewing school, but are very, very, very much superseded by what you've learned in practice. And some beers I can conjure without a pilot brew because I have a lot of experience with previous versions, but other beers are kind of out in left field and need some test brews to really dial in.
Yeah. So it's about developing that muscle memory over years and years. If you're going to forego, say, a test brew on something, it's going to be a beer like your body sort of just intrinsically knows how to make at this point. Yeah.
Yes. Like that was with the Pilsner that we made. When I was thinking about that beer, the mashing process, the malts that we would use, the yeast that we would use, the temperatures, those were all pretty well wrote. I know that from experience that this is going to give me a certain outcome. So this is what I'm going to do. But my question really was what hop blend do I want to use? So I went and I knew I wanted to use German noble hops. So I went to Germany after harvest in 2022, and it was not a great harvest, but actually the hops turned out to be surprisingly good. And I rubbed lots of different hops, and I would take a handful of this variety and a handful of that variety and a handful of the third variety, put a little bit together and kind of just make a rough idea. Well, if it's, you know, half this hop, one quarter this and one quarter that, put it together and rub it. Nope, that's not it. Let me try a different blend. And keep trying different combinations until I found something that at least gets me in the ballpark. Yeah, these are the five hop varieties that I want to use in this beer, and this is more or less the blend that I want to use, and I'm going to put in this kind of newer, new age hop to give it a little bit of a pop and blend them all together, sign a contract to buy the hops, and wait for them to arrive and brew.
So if I'm taking to an analogy, the beginning part of a beer recipe for you as a brewer with, you know, where you've had this brewery for 30 years this year, and, you know,
doing it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Now.
40 years brewing experience is one is you kind of, you know, the style well enough to know how to play your instrument, right?
Yeah.
And you're playing a Stradivarius, so you know you're on, you know, the best machines you can have, and if not, they're the machines you've been using, and you're very attuned to them.
Yeah.
And then the second part is after 40 years knowing your ingredients and what the ratios are going to do, sort of blind without sort of double checking. Well, I know if these come together, I'm going to get this. And if I add this new thing in, I think I'm going to get that. So I can sort of play around there.
Sure.
And that all comes from experience. After 40 years, do you still have beers that you're going to brew where you're sort of out on a limb, or you're sort of out on a ledge of like, oh, gee, I really don't know. And how does that process sort of work at that point?
Well, if it's a beer that I've really don't have experience with, the first thing that I'll do is in our lab, all of our raw materials, whether it's water or malt or hops, everything gets assessed in the lab on a sensory analysis. So if it's a new malt that we've never used, we'll make a hot steep. We'll make like a tea with the malt and taste it. Look at the color. Is this the color we want? Is this the aroma, the flavor? And we try to imagine what that would be, how that will manifest itself in the final beer. And of course there has to be a total absence of off character. Then when you have malt, for example, especially specialty malts, there's a batch to batch of variation. So we are not only asking that we want to try, say, you know, a given Munich malt from a given supplier, we're going to nail down even the lot, because there's lot to lot variation. So what we might say, this is a perfect Munich malt for this beer, but then when we go to order it, we get a different lot, and it's different. And that's just inherent in a biological process. So we try to nail down all of those things in advance. So having really good raw materials and be willing to communicate with your supplier what you're looking for, and be willing to pay a fair price for that is kind of where you start. Then we'll put something on paper, or I'll put something on paper, and it is often based on the 200 plus recipes I've done in the past. So I'll find a like beer, maybe a beer that's similar in character, and I'll use that as a starting point. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a 15-year-old recipe, and certainly I've learned a lot over those 15 years, and I know a lot more now than I did 15 years ago. So the tricks that I've learned will then be applied to that old recipe, and put together a plan for a small batch, and mm-hmm. we'll make a pilot brew in our little pilot brewery. We can make 24 liters at a time, and we'll brew a small batch.
Yeah. And just as a little aside there, I love the way that pilot brewery looks. It is like stainless steel, and it's like everything just in miniature.
Yeah. It's definitely a mini large brewery. It's got the correct depth for a louder ton. I actually bought it at an auction at a brewery in Texas. It was a pilot plant from Stroh's.
Oh, cool.
So, it was probably built in the 60s, but I can't imagine all of the great brewers that have used this pilot plant before me. And I think it was at a Lone Star at an auction, and they had in the lab, they had this pilot plant. So I bid on the pilot plant, and they had file cabinets, I don't know, 20 file cabinets full of test results from all of the research that had been done at Stroh's for decades.
Really?
It's just beautiful information.
Yeah.
And so this auction, you know how auctions are, they were selling these as file cabinets. And I bid on the pilot plant and got it. And then I went to lunch. And when I came back, they had sold the file cabinets, and whoever bought the file cabinets, you know, they bought them for whatever, $25 a file cabinet.
Yeah.
With the idea that they were going to, you know, whatever,
file destroy some these. Stuff.
Well, yeah, you could buy the file cabinets, but throw away all of these decades of research. So it was a real tragedy that I lost the opportunity to have years and years of beautiful research from one of the, you know, iconically great Michigan breweries, but I guess that's another story. But
yeah,
so we'll make a pilot brew, and then we'll taste it. We'll look at how it ferments. We'll look at how you know, what the outcome is for bitterness and color and pH and taste, and we'll run it through the process. Make notes on any deficiencies. Oh, we have to pitch at a higher rate. Oh, we need to be warmer in our fermentation. You know, we need more dark malt. Whatever. And then we'll taste it, and we'll get together in the taste panel. And usually at this point, I'll include Deb, because Deb's a really good taster, and mm-hmm. we'll say, okay, it needs to be more malty, or it needs to be lighter bodied, or more drinkable, or it needs to be more bitter. And then we may make another pilot brew. And if it's a beer that is something that I really don't have a handle on, we might make 4 or 5 or 6 permeations of that pilot brew.
Yeah.
And then if we really are unsure, or we really want to nail it, then we'll maybe come down here to Riverside and make a single small batch. We can make, say, 40 barrels at a time, mm-hmm. 80 keg equivalents, and make a small batch as a beta test. And then from that, we can really nail down what we want the recipe to be. And out of that comes a beer.
And so we were talking a little bit before this, and I had mentioned, you know, you and I, would, you know, when you're a cook, someone basically hands you a piece of paper and says that's beef stroganoff.
That's right.
So there you go. That's how you make that. It's not the same for brewers though, right? Like if someone just had your recipe book, they could make an approximation, but there's too much variable is what I'm hearing.
Oh yeah. A recipe is certainly much, much more than a piece of paper. A piece of paper is a roadmap, but it doesn't really tell you the journey. So for example, in our brewery, we have lots of brewers. So there's lots of hands that mm-hmm. are involved in making a beer, and lots of steps and processes and hundreds of junctions and points of decision. And So a recipe might say, a fermentation recipe might say, you know, step one, do this, and refer to SOP, your standing operating procedure 8-24. And that will be a whole list of things that go into that particular step.
Yeah.
So it's really can be very, very complicated. It's not just, you know, pump the beer from this tank to that tank. There's hard fought lessons about all of the little minutiae of idiosyncrasies that go into each step of the process. And so the recipe sheet is sort of like an executive summary.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And you had mentioned something in one of your earlier answers when you were saying, okay, so I'm trying to make a new beer and I have, you know, these 15 or 30 years of beer recipes to look back on. Do you find when you're looking to build a new beer and you're starting sort of at a reference point from something you did prior, that gives you like a certain measure of like baseline safety and security of like, okay, this is something I know works that I can then build off of?
Yeah. Use it as a starting point, jumping off point, because what you can do is, so let's say when I want to make Gyrator Doppelbock, mm-hmm. So we have Ufta, which is a single Bock. So I'll look at the recipe for Ufta and I'll think about, okay, the last time we brewed that, for example, maybe we brewed it in 2016. So what I knew in 2016, or my abilities, my talent was, now I'm 7 years smarter.
Yeah.
And I also have 7 years of experience and new equipment and lots of clever people helping me on the brewing team and in the lab. So we have all of these things that will make the beer better. Then I actually sometimes will even go to things like greatbeer.com or Untappd and look at, well, what did people think about this beer? Is it too sweet? It's too bitter. It's too dark. It's too light. And mm-hmm. that will also give me some bearing on directions that I might go for a new recipe. And then the last thing, and what I always tell people is to imagine in your mind's eye what this beer looks like, what it tastes like, what it smells like, what's the foam look like, what's the color, what's the clarity? And that helps you also to be a guide to where you want to go with this recipe.
So getting something from your head onto the page and then into the bottle, right?
Yeah.
It seems like there's like at least two or three layers of interpretation that happens between head and bottle, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But yes.
Yeah. So one of the things I think is interesting, and especially in talking to a brewer like you, at the scale you're brewing at now, when you're talking about like a, you know, a beta test batch on down here at Riverside, like an 80 keg equivalent, does there ever become a time when you're testing it out and you're testing it out that you just go, okay, I know this is going to go, or not go, but I know it's ready for at least a one big batch run. Mm-hmm. And how does that decision-making process get made? Because in my head, and I'm sorry if I'm rambling a little bit, that seems to be like, would have to be one of the scarier decisions making in recipe writing, is actually pulling the trigger and saying, yes, I'm going to brew a lot of this beer.
Yeah, it is. It is a big deal. And as a side note, in some ways, I envy people in tap room breweries. Mm-hmm. I hear podcasts and brewers talk. They say things like, "Oh, we never brew the same beer ever. We just are always trying different things." And they, you know, always have a rotating different type of IPA that they're making. And
yeah.
I envy that, because that's a great way to learn, but and so that we could never really do that with, you know, we have 100 barrel brew kettles and we have to sell beer, you know, measured in increments of 100 barrels. So it has to be something that can go out into the world. And then we also have to funnel it through our wholesalers. So the story about a given beer has to be communicated to the wholesaler, and then it has to go out and be communicated to the retail. So we can't really, if we have shelf space for a given brand, it can't be constantly changing. It has to be a brand that is in that space. But if you have a tap room, people walk in and say, "What do you got new?" So,
yeah.
So that is a real luxury of being in a small tap room brewery. But the downside is you never get to be an expert in anything. Mm-hmm. You may really, you know, have opinions on 100 different hop varieties, but you're never an expert on one variety. And what I'll often tell hop farmers and hop brokers that are constantly bringing me new varieties, I think it's fun to think about new varieties and to try new varieties, but it takes me lots of years to really understand what this variety means and how it performs and how to use it. And I can't do it, you know, every week, something different. It's impossible. So like this idea, you know, we've talked about our Pilsner this year, that is a result of years and years and years of funneling and fine tuning and tweaking to get to the point where we have something that we really like. And, if you're always making something different, you're really the master of none.
And yeah. No, like a mile wide and an inch deep.
Yeah.
No, I had, in my previous career in politics, we had policy experts in every office, right? You know, this is the education person. This is the healthcare person. This is the ag person.
Well, an expert is just somebody with a briefcase and 200 miles from their home or something like that.
Yeah. So. And just the time to really focus in on that thing. I was always the communications person. So I had to pull from all of those, but I never was the person who's like, all right, I need to be able to drill down into one thing, because my job was condensing all of that into a thing. So I definitely feel that analogy and how it works, because if you are just constantly sort of just dipping your toes into different pools, you're never going to jump all the way in and sort of really define what it is that you're about and that you do, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, certainly tap room brewers, there's a lot of really, really spectacularly great brewers that are in such a situation. But it comes as a double-edged sword.
Yeah, there's up and downsides to both to both issues. That's like they have the flexibility to say, we're going to have something new. Every time you come and see us, we'll have something new.
The other thing about brewers is they like to brew. All brewers most brewers in my experience are always trying to make their beer a little bit better. And a little bit better, it's sort of like you're standing in a rushing river and the water is just rushing by you, and you're your toes are grabbing on the rocks on the bottom and you're just trying not to fall over. But in order to do that, you're constantly tweaking and moving to keep balanced. And in some ways that's how it is in a brewery. And also competition is fierce and there's a lot of really wonderful beers out there. So it's about tweaking it to make it a little bit better, a little bit better. And the biggest thing about beer, the most modern problem, is shelf stability. Mm-hmm. Again, at tap rooms, you make the beer, you put it into a serving tank, and you sell it within a week or two.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like a perfect situation for beer.
I'm like so jealous. Mm-hmm. But for a brewery like mine, where we have to sell the beer that's going to be out, and you have no idea, someone may buy a six pack and put it in their basement for a year. And
then so you get the email.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the biggest issue is for us, for breweries that like ours, it's less about how it tastes coming out of the finished beer tank, but how is it going to taste after a month or two in the can or the bottle or the keg? And that is a lot of shelf stability is what we call it, is where a lot of effort is put into making sure that we do everything in a meticulous way, that we minimize oxygen pickup, we minimize iron pickup, and we minimize excessive heat to try to make sure that the beer will be as robustly, just like a person, you know, you want to age well.
Yeah. You want the old knees to be working well into your 70s.
And yeah, that's right.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And what struck me in what you just said is the sort of implied idea that even when you pull the trigger, right, even when you make the decision, this beer is going to be a big batch, we're going to make a heck of a lot of it, we're going to send it out into the market and see how it does. And by the way, from what I've been hearing, Pilsner is doing really well.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of articles referencing like, get it now, because we're not sure how long this absolutely wonderful beer is going to last on these shelves, which I bet for you is always good to read and hear things like that.
Yeah.
but you've pulled the trigger on it and now it's out there, but the recipe, it sounds like isn't done at that point, right? Because now you got to have, do you have like some setback in your warehouse for reserve to say, okay, 3 months, go pull me a bottle of that Pilsner? Or how does that
work? Yes. Yeah. We have what we call a library. And in the library, we store our beers and we Sam Bennett, who you've interviewed is our sensory manager. Will taste the beer at 1 month and 3 months, and see how the beer holds up. And they score the beer on levels of oxidation. And we also have some tests. We have a special machine that will measure electron spin resonance is the name of a test that we can kind of get an idea how the beer will age. But really the only way to do it is to hold it at room temperature for 3 months and then taste it.
Yeah.
And score it based on a trained taste panel saying the level of oxidation is X. And that's an important attribute.
And then I guess another question I had is, you know, you're talking to artists, writers, painters, you know, the like Deb is a wonderful painter. You get the impression that, you know, the idea in your head and what comes out on the page or the canvas are never exactly matching, right? There's always, you know, in the mind of the artist, like, oh, I could have done this part a little better. I could have done that part a little better.
Yeah, for sure.
Brewing is art and science. So when you have a picture in your head of what that beer is going to come out as, do you find it that you're sort of grappling against two things? One, just like the intrinsic thing of like what I can imagine is always going to be just slightly better than what I can produce, because that's how we keep, you know, progressing and moving forward. And the other being just like you have no control over sort of some of the sciencey stuff behind it.
Well, there certainly is a tension. I mean, the duality of science and art is that alchemy is what attracted me to brewing in the first place. And on one hand, you're right that you develop a recipe with a calculator in hand to say so many kilos of malt, so many hectoliters of water is going to generate so much percent alcohol, so much bitterness, so much color units, so much haze units. And that's all done with the calculator. And that outcome is you want to be able to hit it so that you don't end up with unexpected outcomes like the wrong alcohol level or the wrong bitterness or the wrong color. And so that's a mathematical and engineering endeavor. And I'm generally pretty good at that because I've done it for so long. The artistic idea is a whole nother ball of wax because you've got water and the minerals that are dissolved in the water. You have the malt, and the malt is you've got crop years, you've got different malt houses, even in an existing malt company. You know, that we buy malt from a malt house in Shakopee, Minnesota. In that malt house, they have six different malt houses. So we always use malt house 1 and 2 because not that it's any better or worse. It's been there since the 1930s, which is kind of cool. But we know what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah.
So those things are kind of important to minimize chaos and to always deal with the same suppliers that are more or less our friends. They're our teammates. They're our friends, and we trust them, and we know what we're going to get from them, and they will bend over backwards to take care of us. I am known in the industry as somebody that will fight tooth and nail for quality. I will fight for how I define quality, because everybody defines quality differently, but I won't really fight you for price.
Yeah.
If you give me the quality that I demand, I'll pay your price, because certainly I want you to make a little bit of money. I don't want you to rip me off.
Well, yeah.
I want you to, you got to be profitable.
And you're investing in the security of the quality of your product at that point.
That's right. That's right.
So
I guess one other thing that's worth mentioning is the tension between continuous improvement and an existing recipe. And, part of the problem, and Deb is always reminding me that you can't change a beer. So for example, if you come out with a recipe, people will try it. Those that like it will continue to buy it. Those that don't like it will not buy it. Now you have a brand, and if you change that brand, the people that didn't like it are not going to try it because they've already said, you know, I've already had it. And I've got 1,000 other choices.
Yeah. You're not going
to
win them.
So I'm not going to try it again because I already had that beer and it's not for me. But then the people that said, I really love the intrinsic value or the taste of this beer, you change it. They're like, oh, they changed the beer. There's a raspberry vinaigrette dressing that I really like, and I've eaten it like pretty much every day for many years.
Yeah.
Well, they changed it. Now it's different. And I don't want it anymore. So mm-hmm. that is the kiss of death.
Yeah, they lost a customer.
Yeah. So Deb is always good to tell me, like, look, you can't change the beer. And our joke is we say the recipe's laminated. There was a pizza advertisement on TV, and it's like you said, like, here's the recipe. And a young guy was in the making pizzas. Why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? And the old guy's like, it's laminated. It's laminated. So our joke is that like Moon Man, that's laminated.
It's laminated. That's Spotted not Cow, going that's nowhere.
Laminated. If I say, you know what, guys, maybe we should try this. They say, no. It's laminated. And you do not mess. These are sacrosanct recipes. You don't change them.
Yeah. That to me is so comical because it's ironic because it's such an obvious thing, but I can see like as you're explaining it in your eye, you're like, but you want to change it. You want to get that one.
Be a little bit brighter, a little bit more pop.
Yeah.
And no, it's perfect.
Cause it is super obvious. You have a brand people like, you don't change it.
Yeah.
And that's got to be a constant war with the like, but if we just did this.
Exactly. It is.
Well, as we're wrapping up, and this was a great discussion about how beer is sort of created, how it goes from, you know, idea to concept to execution. One thing that strikes me, and, you know, of course, not asking you to disclose anything future plans wise, but I know for creative people, you know, sometimes you get stuff that's just like stuck in your brain and you start ruminating on like a concept or anything. Do you got any of that going on in your head right now?
Yeah, I do. And out of that will be a beer that we're releasing it in July.
In July?
So, I'm as excited about it as I was the pills. And I have no idea whether people will like it. I have no idea. If it's going to be like most, a beer is either like, wow, that's really good. You know, I want another one, or it could be like, oh, well, thanks. What else you got? And I never know. So, yeah. I got my fingers crossed and we'll come out with a new beer, a seasonal, mm-hmm. beer. It'll be in 12 pack cans and 6 pack bottles. And I will put it out there. Bare my soul and see if people like it or not.
And see how the return comes.
Yeah, right.
Well, Dan, I will let you get back to your busy, busy day. Thank you again for making time with us. Again, there will be a new seasonal package to look forward to in July. Details on that to come. Thank you for your time, Dan.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
Yeah, no problem. You have a nice day.